You made the comment in your Goodyear Medal address that, and I was intrigued by it, you spent quite a bit of time in, let's say, the early 40s, you learned to memorize, yeah, characterizing the results, and you said that without the sophisticated techniques that we now have available, the whole study was an exciting adventure, and you wondered whether some of that is missing in the...
Well, I often wonder about that, that the young people have all these tools at their command. And in fact, John Spire and I reminisce about this. John is a little upset because most of the people that work for him work with 5cc, and they take it up and get an infrared and an NMR and a few other things, and they conclude that they've accomplished what they want. We never could do that. We had to make a pound or two. And as John said, when he asked one of his men to make a pound or two, and I said, oh, I've never done that. They can't make a pound or two of anything. Mm-hmm. And we had to make pounds of stuff all the time. We were working with 12-liter flasks, 22-liter flasks, and fortunately we had glass coheaters and variacs and that sort of thing. But without that, we wouldn't have done all we did either. I mean, we were forced to make quantities of material. And then we had to distill the doggone stuff, and we had to learn to distill, and it wasn't easy. Operating a still is a little bit of an art, not really a science. And so that was a little bit of a problem all the way along.
Could we talk a little bit about some of the people you may have interacted with at this time? Then I wanted to look at some of the other, some of the results of,
all right,
of the work here at Dow Corning. Any comments on Frank Hyde?
Yes, we interacted with Frank Hyde regularly. We would go to Corning for meetings. We also came up here to Midland for meetings. So we had a good chance to interact, and Frank was a real chemist. In other words, he was always involved in his work, no question of that. He still is today, as a matter of fact. He comes up to Midland and talks about things. Yes. So he's really still interested in what goes on. I think you might enjoy interviewing him sometime.
Yes, I was just making a note of that.
The only... problem is Frank's wife has a very severe case of Alzheimer's, and so he's got a 24-hour-a-day job, really. We were down to see him last winter for a short time, and she just constantly wants to take a walk. Well, my wife walked with her three different times, and she'd come back from a walk and sit still for 5 minutes and then want to go again. Well, we met a number of people from Corning.
Britton was at Dow.
Well, the other Corning people were Dr. O.K. Johansson, Dr. William Dowd, and Robert Fleming. Those were three of Frank's group. There was a girl there by the name of Mary Purcell. Fleming, Dowd, and Johansson came to Midland later when the Corning group moved to Midland. They moved in the early 50s. The Mellon group partially moved to Midland. Dr. McGregor came in 55, and John Spire and I came in 56, but we couldn't convince anybody else in the Pittsburgh Fellowship to come to Midland. So we continued the fellowship at Mellon Institute for, I'd say, another 6 years, with decreasing numbers in it, although for a time there were about six people left in it. And then finally we decided to cut off all that outside. If they wanted to come to Midland, fine. If not, we were not going to continue the work at Mellon Institute. This was in the, I would say, the late 60s.
Shaler Bass.
Shaler Bass was, he was the director of research under Bill Collings, and he was quite a man. He was always interested in new things, and he did a lot of research. He ultimately had two men working with him, for him, Dr. Melvin J. Hunter and Dr. Arthur J. Barry, who were heads of two different groups of researchers within his bailiwick. And there was another man, T.A. Kaupi, K-A-U-P-P-I. Kaupi was head of product development under Dr. Collings. And so he was more or less what we call TS&D today, technical service and development. Shaler was really head of research for a time before he became vice president and then later president of the company. And I would say shortly after the war ended, he went to Europe on an invitation from the British government to come over and tell them about silicones, because I guess through war channels they'd been hearing something about silicones. So he went over and talked a number of places to the British General Electric Company, which has no relationship to ours. It's GEC over there. And they were pretty much the moving force behind European or English interest at any rate. While he was there, he did talk to Dr. Kipping, and Kipping wanted to know, this is quite interesting, wanted to know, was there anything really new in silicones? And Shaler was telling him all about these polymers. He said, no, anything new in the chemistry. So later on, Shaler was able to take back to him a full set of his papers, and that was good because they had a fire in his laboratory at Sussex, and he'd lost all of his papers, but Shaler had copies made of all of his papers and gave him a volume of his collected papers. He was really quite touched by that.
I read that Britton did that with the people here.
That's right. Maybe,
did you get one of those? Or?
Well, we had a number of those volumes made up. Mel Hunter started this, put the Kipping papers in a set of volumes, and then from that point on we had some other papers in other volumes. So we had a set of about four or five volumes, loosely bound, of papers that were... Dr. Britton said he regarded them pretty much as a Bible for this thing. However, really all they told us was the Grignard technique. He was looking for optical activity. He was looking for unsymmetrically substituted silicons and how that optical activity related to carbon activity. And, well, that's a viable field, but there was a lot more to it than that. So these books rattled around the labs for a long time, but I went down recently to check in the library, and I said, do you have those books? And the library said, what books? I said, you don't mean to tell me that you don't have these anymore. They don't have any of them anymore. I don't know what they did.
Oh, that's a shame.
I don't know, because I had to sit here for a long time, and I finally said, well, why don't I give them back to them and they can keep them? They must have got tired keeping them and then just threw the whole bunch out. So, really, there was no one that remembered that there had been a set of these even. And in fact, Mel Hunter started something else after that. He started to collect individual papers of people that Dow Corning published. So we had a paper for every person that had published, and so we made numbers of these collected volumes up. And those were thrown out. Well, again, I've kept my own, but I didn't have a volume of the collected papers of everybody else. But Dr. Hunter ultimately became director of research, and Art Barry became his associate director. And when I moved to Midland in 56, my title was assistant director of research, so I was part of the group. But I had a small group working for me here, and the field we worked in was radiation chemistry. We were doing a lot of work in radiation chemistry. We'd learned the effect of electrons, electron beams. We'd done work in Boston using an accelerator there that they had, and we'd done some gamma ray work, and Dow had a gamma source at that time, and we did some work over there.
Was that didn't Grebe move into that area?
Yes, he had done work in Dow in that field. Yes, I didn't know Grebe except by reputation. I never actually met the man, but I did get to know a number of people who were in charge of that radiation facility over there, because we did give some things some very high doses, and we actually sent things down to reactors. General Dynamics, we put things in a reactor down there to see how they behaved and so on. All of this started from work we did back at Mellon. We did our first radiation in a cyclotron. The man who ran the cyclotron at the University of Pittsburgh asked if we'd like to put something in the beam, and we said, well, sure. So we put things in, and lo and behold, we found that it really knocked the tar out of them. And so in some lighter doses, we found that it did do some vulcanization, so we figured on the works of vulcanization and that sort of thing could be done. And then we later on showed how much radiation they would take, and phenol-containing materials were more resistant and so on. Later on, my group here, when I first came up here in 56, I had four men working with me, and several of them got interested in this field, and we developed the G factors for various bonds and various groupings on silicon and that sort of thing, as to how much radiation it would take to do various things.
Could we go back to, again, the beginning of the Dow Corning?
Yes.
You were still at Mellon.
Right.
And there were a number of applications that were coming out. Sheridan Bass had used your 200 fluid to work
to make this grease. Yes, the so-called DC4 compound was the first product that the company had, and it was used in the aircraft that flew from this country to England and to North Africa. Planes couldn't fly over water at high altitudes in those days because they were piston-driven engines, rotary engines, and the ignition system would be subject to corona at high altitudes and especially over water, and you'd lose ignition and now the engine stops. So they knew that, and they wanted to deliver these planes because they were running into trouble with the convoys. The convoys were getting shot down. So they developed this harness of a series of pipes that led out to each spark plug, because each cylinder had two plugs, and there were seven all the way around, and I've forgotten exact numbers, but anyway, this whole network was a hollow tube with the ignition cable going down the center of it, and then they just filled it with this grease, with a grease gun, because our stuff didn't subject itself to corona, and it also resisted moisture very well. It kept moisture out. Well, they found that they could fly. They could stay up only a few minutes prior to that, and after that they were gone. Well, now with this stuff, they were up 8 hours, and it didn't make any difference, and so they began to fly them. Well, then the second point was necessary to get them over there, because on the ground, those engines absorb material in the oil in the crankcase, and at high altitudes then that stuff foamed out and just dropped out of the engine. Now you lost engines from lack of lubrication. So they found Gulf oil very early found that a small amount of our 200 fluid in a petroleum product defoamed it. So from that point on, all aircraft and tanks and everything else that had this foaming problem used oil that was defoamed with our 200 fluid. And those two products, plus the use of 200 fluid on instruments as a damping thing on a needle, that was one of the uses during the war. So there were only about three uses during the war, and that was about all. But we were, in the meantime, working on other things. We were working on laminating resins, work we started at Mellon on what we called mono-tri resins, resins with only one substituent and resins with three. Those resins... Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'll be tearing your machine apart.
No, no problem. A
paper by Paul Slory indicated that you could carry a so-called mono-tri resin further towards gelation without gelling it than you could with any other system. So we tried this, and we found we could make some good laminating resins this way. And those resins later became some Dow Corning laminating, because as you make a motor with glass cloth windings and all that, you still need laminates, so-called slot sticks and various other things, even control panels and so on, had to be made out of a glass cloth with laminating resins. So one of the resins that was needed was not only this impregnating resin, but also the laminating resin. So Frank Hyde's resin was used for a long time in the very early electric motors. Westinghouse made most of the motors in the early days because they worked with us at Mellon. They had a fellowship at Mellon, and they made motors, and we tested them up here. We had a testing laboratory in Midland where full-size motors were run continuously at various temperatures, and we would run them for life tests, so to speak, at 200 degrees centigrade, 225, 250 degrees centigrade, and measured the so-called life test of these resins. A chap by the name of George Grant did this for Dow Corning. And
did you do any applications work yourself? I heard that you had used silicone caulking in your house in Pittsburgh.
Yes, I did. Well, actually, we make... I built a house in Pittsburgh in 48, outside Pittsburgh in the north side, North Hills, and we put aluminum windows in with the idea that that would cut down maintenance and all the rest of it. And about a year afterwards, I began to find that the putty was falling out. And I said to the chap that put them in, I said, what's the matter? I said, this is falling out. He said, well, that needed painting. I said, you mean to tell me I was going to have to paint that doggone stuff? He said, oh, yes. I said, well, I thought with aluminum windows you could get a caulking material that I wouldn't have to paint. Oh, no. And I thought, well, for heaven's sakes, we need a caulk now. So we did a lot of work in the lab mixing up various things, and we did make some caulks, and I put caulks on my windows. Then I made one for a big 4-foot double pane windows, like thermopanes, and along the front edge of that window I put a bead of this new caulk that I'd made, which had a curing mechanism by painting an amine in solution on the outside, and so the skin cured but the inside didn't, and for all I know it's still there. And this was more or less the beginnings of interest in caulking compound. We actually never did any work at Mellon on the sealants and the caulking compounds, although that was done in Frank Hyde's lab up here. But
you did the original work, and then
we did the we suggested the idea that caulks were needed, and we did some of these compounds. Well, what the one that I put on the window was a chlorine containing one, and when you treated it with a diamine, why, it would react and form a crosslink, so it would vulcanize with the formation of with the addition of a diamine. Well, my only application work was finding out very early on that the 200 fluid had this so-called flat slope. Gulf reported back to us that it had a very good, what they called, viscosity index. So then I got into the business of measuring viscosity over ranges of temperature, and sure enough, the darn thing was very, very flat. So we began to exploit that and point that out in our literature, that that was one of the big benefits of this thing. The company published a book about 200 fluid very early on, in which we listed a lot of properties of the material, but truly most of the applications came from people on the outside saying, I have this problem, and we would suggest, well, why don't you try this? And most of the times those things worked, but they were not really things that we worked on initially.
Maybe this is the time to move on to the rubber aspect.
Okay.
There was indication that you said you knew early on that high molecular weights would be the key.
Right.
How did you know that?
Well, we more or less knew from reading about rubber that high molecular weights were used, and we knew what rubber, raw rubber, looked like. And every now and again, we'd have a batch of gelled BC4 compound or just 200 fluid, and it was quite rubbery, but nothing was ever done about it until it was the fall of 43, I guess it was. I'd have to look up my notes up there, but anyway, DuPont published a paper on their Paracon rubber. And they didn't say anything in that about what the vulcanizing agent was. But we knew it was a rubber that didn't have any unsaturation in it. And a friend of ours from across the hall at Mellon said, oh, the vulcanizing agent is benzoyl peroxide. Oh. Well, I said, if that works on a saturated rubber for DuPont, it ought to work for us. And I tried it, and sure enough, it gelled our rubber. It gelled our 200 fluid. So right away we took some ordinary 200 fluid of about 1,000 centistoke and added a little bit of benzoyl peroxide, gelled it up to the point where it was now a rubber-like gel, milled it with some more filler and a little bit more peroxide, and put it in the mold, and sure enough, we had a rubber. Wasn't very strong. I can remember bringing the first samples up, and this T.A. Copy, Andy Copy, crushed it up in his fingers, and it was nothing but a powder. I said, Andy, you didn't need to do that to tell me that it was weak. I knew it was weak. So we went on from there trying to improve on it, and a lot of people got involved in improving the rubber. O.K. Johansson, for instance, was one of them. He developed an alkali process for polymerizing, and during the course of that polymerization, if they ran it a little too hot, it would gel. And so a number of the gels called K-gels, they were pretty high-strength materials because they were pretty high molecular weight before they gelled. And those became good raw materials for rubber. But it wasn't until 1950, and I had a chap by the name of Silas Braley working for me, and one of the fellowships at Mellon Institute had asked us to prepare a thin sheet of rubber, because they had the idea that they could separate oxygen and nitrogen because of the difference in speed of diffusion through that film. Well, an ordinary sheet of unfilled rubber wasn't strong enough. And so I said to him, well, take some of that high polymer that we've got out there and add some of that Lindy A silica that we have out there. We haven't done anything with that. And he did, milled it in, and molded a real thin sheet, and he came back real excited because it was strong. And sure enough, we measured it, and it was about four or five times stronger than anything we had seen up to that point. So we went on from there to show that it needed two things, high molecular weight polymers and a low particle size silica. And we looked at silicas, we looked at everything else that was fine. We looked at copper thalassiamine, we looked at even hemoglobin from blood, because it was a small particle material. Everything that was small did work to some extent, but it turned out that silicas were ideally suited for this. And so when we showed that high-strength rubber in Midland, they got excited right away. And that was the quickest transfer from lab to product of any product that they had ever had. I'd say within 2 months they had a product out. Of course, what we hadn't known... because we milled things and molded them right away. But if you milled one of these rubbers and left it stand around before you molded it, it would set up in the can. It did what we called crepe hardening. And pretty soon, even though they started selling product, more product was coming back than was going out, and the company was really upset. So a lot of work went on to show what was needed to get around that. We did a lot of work on treating the filler itself to make it less reactive, because really what was happening, the filler was reacting with the polymer. And finally, Keith Palmentier up here came upon what we call PA fluid, which was a hydroxy-ended silicone, and that worked beautifully, and they added that as sort of a plasticizer, and from that point on there was no problem about the crepe hardening.
I guess I should ask you about silly putty.
Well,
we did some early polymerization with boric oxide, which I...
We tried it, yes.
Was there any reason you selected boric oxide?
Well, yes, because we thought, maybe a little mistakenly, but one of the reasons we weren't able to make these things go high molecular weight was that they were hydroxy-ended. And we had, of course, read Carruthers' work on ester changes, and so that we knew what we had to do to make them go high. We thought, well, boric oxide's a good dehydrating agent. It might pull water out of here. So we put it in, and of course, lo and behold, it went into the chain. It became SIOBSI, and the other thing down there. Well, it behaved like a rubber. It bounced, and then you could mold it like a putty, and we didn't know what to do with it, really. We made a lot of it and just kept it on the shelf.